couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films, Dear Evan Hansen, This Is the Year, the TV series Foundation, Star Wars Visions, and Creepshow Season 3. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the Trailer Park, and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring The Gateway and Alone in the Dark. Not the Uwe Boll movie, but the one from 1982. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Unfortunately, we had another celebrity pass away this week that I really took notice of, and that was Willie Garson. He died of cancer. He was only 57 years old. Most famously, he was in Sex and the City. He played Carrie's gay best friend. But he was also in the series White Collar. He played Matt Bomer's friend, Mozzie, who helped him with all his little scams and cheats. And he showed up in some of the Stargate episodes. I watched the Stargate series, Stargate SG-1. He had a little bit part in that for a couple episodes, and he showed up in a lot of things. And he was, I wouldn't say a versatile actor, but he certainly fit that mold of that kind of quirky, nerdy little guy. And he was very fun in everything I watched him, and I always enjoyed him. And he was very noticeable and very memorable. So it's sad to see him go. So rest in peace, Willie Garson. The next piece of news I want to talk about is a little bit more about Shang-Chi, and the reason I'm covering that so much is we're tracking the box office to see how well these Marvel movies do without the hybrid release. The fact that this week there was a big announcement from Disney that Shang-Chi is going to debut on Disney Plus on what they're calling Disney Day, which is, you know, that's not a national holiday or anything, but it's going to be taking place on November 12th. Now, they're going to be releasing a bunch of stuff in November. I think they're gearing up for the holidays, and they're gearing up for people to continue their subscriptions. But more importantly, it's looking at the release window for Shang-Chi, which is a little bit more than 2-month theatrical window, but there's no premium pricing for Disney+. They're going and just putting it right on the service. So it's sort of the hybrid of the hybrid. And make no mistake, this is a test. They're seeing when's a good time to drop it on the service. What they want to do is they want to maximize the amount of people that will pay a premium price for it before it goes to the service. They don't want to put it on Disney Plus for free 15 days after it's in theaters because you're not going to get enough ticket sales. And they're watching the tracking of it. And Shang-Chi did well. It did very well for a third weekend for a Marvel movie, but it's, you know, nearing its end of its run and the end of the money it's going to be making. So they're going to be playing around with this in 2022. They're calculating which is better, to do the day and date with a premium charge or a theatrical exclusive and a subscription retention. And they might also scale things back. So, I mean, I think declaring some form of hybrid release model is dead is premature. Either way, at least from this point forward, the bottom line is you're going to see at maximum a roughly 60-day window to wait to see something come onto Disney Plus, which is tiny compared to what they used. I mean, it used to be like 3 or 4 or 6 months for a DVD or Blu-ray release. Well, now it's shrinking even faster. But when it comes to box office, Shang-Chi, it should be, by the time I'm done talking here, it should be outgrossing Black Widow. And at least for the theatrical numbers, you can't say that it made more money than Black Widow because Black Widow still made $125 million on the Disney Plus premium charges. Now, both movies are going to be stymied in terms of their overall box offices because of China. Black Widow's approved to release in China, but when it was going to, there was like a blackout in terms of foreign films coming to China, and so it didn't get in there at the sweet spot. And now that it's been out for a couple months, and they're always saying piracy. I still think piracy is a bit of a boogeyman when it comes to box office pundancy. I mean, it certainly harms the studios, but not to the level that I think they say it is. But it might harm international release. Who knows? but the time may have passed for it to release in China. But more specifically, Shang-Chi's not going to get a release in China, and apparently that's due to comments that the lead actor, Simu Liu, had said about China itself, which, you know, it was critical of the country, critical of some of their politics, and so they're not going to approve Shang-Chi. At least that's what the word on the street is. And after that, let's see how well Eternals does. And Eternals might not get released in China, too. That's like a 1-2-3 punch of badness for Disney, because Disney wants those numbers. I mean, the numbers for China are huge. They're the second biggest box office moneymaker from a country perspective than the U.S., and sometimes even more so than the U.S. So we're still going to be seeing flexibility and testing waters and doing different strategies for blockbusters and, in particular, smaller flicks going into and throughout 2022. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to hit is Finch. It's coming to Apple TV on November 5th. I think they're doing a theatrical release as well, or it's coming to Apple TV November 5th.
Now, if you can speak, tell me something about you.
Robots must protect dog.
Hey, what's all the fuss?
I learned to talk dog. I don't think it likes me.
Do you think we'll make it?
Not without my team. What we do together.
I believe in you, Fish.
This one stars Tom Hanks, and it's essentially a guy and a dog and a robot going across the desolate wasteland trying to find safety. And, you know, they're running into nature disasters. They're running into windstorms and problems there, but they're also running into potential dangers from other people. Because, you know, in the apocalypse, you don't just have to worry about the world around you. You have to worry about the people in the world around you, because we all know that as people get pushed up against the wall, some will be good, but some will revert into very bad things. So this looks really sweet. I mean, it looks really great. I mean, I'm watching this movie and I'm like, doggone it, Tom Hanks. Every time he makes a movie, it's something that sucks me in. You know, even something like News of the World, which was not my favorite Tom Hanks movie, but I thought it was really good. I mean, it's an emotional, very nice, nuanced performance by him. And this one looks equally as good. I'm looking forward to this one. I'm really hoping that this has, you know, a feel-good punch to it. I hope it doesn't kill you. You know, I hope it's not going to kick you in the stomach or something like that. So I'm looking forward to Finch. The next one I want to hit is Nightmare Alley, the new Guillermo del Toro movie, which comes out to theaters on December 17th.
Step right up and behold one of the unexplained mysteries of the universe. Is he man or beast? They've got by the same lust and threat that got us all walking on this earth, but gone wrong somehow in the maternal womb. Is it a beast or is it a man? You're in luck, because tonight you will see him feed.
I've not seen the original Nightmare Alley. I don't know how much this is relating to the movie. I'm going to watch the original movie before this one comes out, if for nothing else, just to have some sort of cinematic background to it. But this looks tailor-made for Guillermo del Toro. I mean, it's a creepy carnival, and it's got a fun house, and it's got these strange characters. I mean, the carnival setting is made for Guillermo del Toro. I mean, like, Tim Burton had that with the Dumbo movie, and I don't know if he quite capitalized on everything he could there, but I really think Guillermo del Toro will. And I'm looking forward to another monster feature that's more sensitive and emotionally nuanced than an old-fashioned monster movie. So I've got a lot of faith in Guillermo del Toro. I think his stuff is coming out fantastic recently. Anyways, that's it for the trailer park. I need to go. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Star Wars Visions, and this is the year. And back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the reviews with Star Wars Visions. A slate of anime directors and companies offer their unique vision to the Star Wars universe in a series of short films.
Long ago, a great warrior came to this village and entrusted our ancestors with this. Its power and responsibility now lie with you.
You've been guided by the Force since you were born.
At last, the moment arrives.
It's the first time I've confronted such darkness. Something ancient and sinister.
This is available on Disney Plus, and unlike some of the other Disney Plus series that are pretty much most everything else that's on the service, the Star Wars Visions series, you get the whole season is all in there for you to binge watch, and there's 9 episodes. They run anywhere from like 9 minutes to 30 minutes. Like the first one's 14 minutes, the next one's 13, you know, and it just fluctuates the how long each episode is because it's however long to tell the story. That's one of the great things about streaming is you're not locked into commercial breaks and stuff like that. Anime has become very, very popular over the last decade or two. I mean, I remember it had a certain popularity in the 90s, and I knew people in the fringes of sci-fi geekdom enjoying anime. But as there's been better ways to proliferate it, and you've had online stuff, and you got like YouTube, and you've got streaming services, anime has really exploded, and it's not just for like diehard geeks anymore. I know a lot of teenagers who are really, really into anime. So it's very, very popular. I mean, older people don't know it, but you know, teenagers, my kids all watch anime and they love it and they know way more about it than I do. And even within anime, even though it has a certain style, there's different styles of anime within anime. And each production company and each director has his or her or its own style to do. And so each one of these is done by a different director. And, you know, they're neat little stories. I mean, they're very anime-ish. I don't know how else to describe it, but there's a lot of stuff in these movies that I say, oh, that's very typical of anime. For example, you know, like the focus on teenagers or younger characters, some of the focus on the music, some of the focus on family relationships. And all that stuff has percolated through the Star Wars universe since the beginning, when Star Wars was originally inspired by not anime, but by Asian filmmaking. I mean, Akira Kurosawa is a huge influence on George Lucas, and in a lot of ways, he was influenced by The Hidden Fortress to do the original Star Wars. I mean, that's old news. Everybody knows that. But even if you look at the Jedi and their teaching and using a lightsaber as a sword, you know, they have all these elements within the structure of the movies that are obviously drawing from Asian influences. So it seems like a natural progression to say, hey, let's get some anime versions of Star Wars. And it deals with different characters. I mean, there's some stuff in the background I think they reference, but pretty much they're their own stories. The biggest drawback is like these things that are like 14, 15 minutes long, they really feel like just a truncated story. It feels like there's a lot more there, but they were just told make it under a half hour. And so you almost feel like you're just getting the climax of the story where there's a lot more to be said and there's a lot more history with the characters. And in a way, this feels like it's a audition for either these anime directors or these anime companies to make a Star Wars movie in the anime style or something that can go directly to Disney Plus. And I wouldn't be surprised if that's what they're doing. Absolutely. That seems to be where they're going with this. I wouldn't be surprised if in a year or two, we see some of these anime artists doing a feature length or a series on Disney Plus that's related to Star Wars. And that's great because it branches out and using different characters. It branches out beyond just the core characters that we have. We're not just doing the Clone Wars or the Bad Batch, which all still have cameos from Palpatine and Grand Moff Tarkin and other people. I mean, it's a whole galaxy. It's nice to just explore other characters. So these do have some great elements to it, but I mean, they are very steeped in anime archetypes, we'll say. and a mixture of archetypes of the anime and archetypes of the Star Wars universe. So if you're not familiar with anime, it can be a little frustrating, and you might get fatigued by watching all of them at once. But if you're a fan of anime and a fan of Star Wars, you know, this is the sweet spot. You're going to love this stuff. So I'm going to have to say Star Wars Visions kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's move on and talk about a movie called This Is the Year. A teen on the verge of graduation spins a lie to get his high school crush to follow him on a cross-country road trip to a music festival.
High school's over. I just need 10 pages answering the question, how was your high school experience?
But a lot of interesting things can happen in the next 3 weeks. I'm talking life-changing events that could completely change my high school experience.
The closing act at Fountain Center this year will be Lovely the Band. When are we leaving?
We?
It's a road trip.
Everything was finally going the way I wanted, and my life is a mess.
Of course your life's a mess. You're a teenager.
High school isn't over yet.
This is directed by David Henry. If you don't know the name, you probably recognize a face if you had a kids or you were a kid, you know, maybe 15 years ago, 10, 15 years ago. He was on the TV series Wizards of Waverly Place. He's also well known for being one of the two children in How I Met Your Mother. He has taken this as his directorial debut. And what he's doing is he's basically paying homage to, well, it says 80s teen comedies, but it feels more like a 90s teen comedy. Because I saw the 80s teen comedies, they play differently. This feels a little more like a 90s one. You know, something, even though it's a very different structure, but something closer to She's All That or Can't Hardly Wait or something like that, rather than it's The Breakfast Club or 16 Candles. But it does have that, nostalgia feel to it, because the main character is a big fan of these older movies, and he wants his high school career to be topped off with falling in love. Well, you know, anybody who's an adult can watch this and be like, ha, 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 you're an idiot, you're just a teenager, you don't know anything about falling in love and relationships or life when you're 17 or 18 years old. But, you know, it's hearts in the right place. Now, it's a bit, and I'm not going to say overwritten, but it's the script feels like it's been workshopped in a script writing course a little bit too much. Like every character gets an arc, and you don't need every character to get an arc. And they always have to have a follow up with every character, and they have to have a resolution, and they have to have, you know, all these elements in there for each character. So it gets a little bit muddled when it really is belonging to only one or two characters. You really don't care about the other ones. It's not about the goofy best friend. It traffics in cliches. It also has stuff that's at times, you know, unbelievable or doesn't actually fit logical the way the world works. But, you know, here's the thing. The bottom line with this movie is its heart's in the right place. And while I wasn't completely smitten with it, I thought it was cute. It was enjoyable and watchable, and it works for what it is. But when you have something that's paying homage to something that's out there already, it's really hard to differentiate yourself and making yourself unique. I mean, every now and then that happens where, you know, it's got something like Happy Days or Grease, which pays homage to the 50s, but they both became iconic in their own rights. I think it's trying to do something like that, but not quite working. But still, it's a cute little movie. It's a sweet story of the end of high school. It seems like he's trying to do some good with this. So I'll give this one a kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Dear Evan Hansen and Creepshow Season 3. Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about Dear Evan Hansen. Based on the award-winning Broadway musical, Ben Platt stars as an awkward teen who is mistaken for the best friend of a classmate who commits suicide.
Even when the dark comes crashing through.
Connor's mother and stepfather here to see you.
When you need a friend to carry you.
Connor wanted you to have this.
And when you're broken on the ground.
Dear Evan Hansen, he wrote it to you.
His last words. Connor took his own life.
I mean, you really gonna tell these people that the only thing they have left of their son is a letter that you wrote to yourself?
So, you and Connor, tell us something, please.
Right,
I started talking.
You couldn't stop.
They didn't want me to stop.
All right, there's been so much talk about Dear Evan Hansen. I know when it came out, what is it, like five or six years ago as a Broadway show, it was a big thing. It was a big deal. And my kids were in theater in high school, so they were aware of it. And I heard the name a lot. And I think my son like sang one of the songs for some performance he did. And so I was aware that it was this big deal. And I mean, Ben Platt, he won like the Tony and the Grammy and the Emmy all at the same time for this show. And like they do when there's anything that's wildly popular, they want to make an adaptation for the big screen. That's a great idea to do. But one of the big things you got to remember is venues are different. Now, a lot of people will understand that a book is different than a movie. But there's this misconception that the stage can translate to the screen well. Sometimes it doesn't. And I think we saw that a little bit with something like In the Heights earlier this year. As much as people enjoyed that movie who saw it, it was not something that translates popularly. Whereas when Disney Plus put Hamilton on, they didn't make a Hamilton movie. They put on this 2.5-hour Broadway show and filmed it. And that's a different, it's different. It is different. And I think that's one of the big things that Dear Evan Hansen suffers from. You've probably by now heard a lot of the complaints and the criticisms of it, not just from when the trailer dropped, but when they had a premiere at, I think, TIFF. There were people that took issue with certain things, in particular Ben Platt's age. And part of the way this movie works is you need to be very empathetic to the character. And because the character does some pretty horrible things. The character's really kind of a monster. Evan Hansen is not a good person. And arguably, I don't know whether he becomes a good person throughout the show, but you have to find sympathy with him. And it takes a very special actor to do so. And he did great on stage doing it. Now, I've never seen it on stage, but from what I understand, he was wonderful and great. And he did a fantastic job. He won a bunch of awards. And I don't know the guy, and I don't know Mark Platt, his father, who produces this. I don't know anything about this, but it feels like Ben Platt was like, ooh, I can win an EGOT for the same character if I just make the movie. I don't know if that's what happened, but it certainly seems like he was fighting to put himself in this movie. And it makes sense because he does know the character, but you need to have a nuanced performance on screen. You got to have a very specific performance on screen. And I guess he could pass a little bit as a teenager, but I heard somebody say that it looks like he's an undercover cop. The character of Evan Hansen is awkward and, he has tics and, you know, he's nervous all the time. And it's not like he's playing some brash bully. I know Ben Platt came out and lashed out at his critics and said, well, have you ever seen Grease? Well, yeah, John Travolta's playing a greaser in that movie. And it's kind of this over the top, sha-na-na type performance anyways that works in that movie. And that's okay. You know, I mean, it's fine because it's a lighthearted film. This deals with heavy stuff. I mean, it deals with suicide and mental illness and a lot of problems that are going on with the youth of today. And when I was a kid, it's just nobody recognized a lot of that stuff. But you need a real special actor to make you feel empathy, and you don't feel the empathy for him because he looks creepy. And the more he tries to look like a teenager, the creepier he gets, which is not good. So you don't feel for the character. You don't get on the character's side. I mean, he does a great performance. The music's good. I mean, the songs are good. They're very catchy. And the rest of the cast is fantastic. You got like Julianne Moore and Amy Adams and Caitlin Dever. And these people do a great job in the role. But beyond even just Platt's performance or appearance in the movie, rather, the story is unnerving. I mean, I'm not going to get into stuff, but there's like stuff in here that I'm like, this is deeper and darker than the movie is even aware it is. And there's some really hefty stuff happening behind the scenes. And the character of Evan Hansen is opportunistic and taking advantage of a situation. I'm falling into it. And it's too nervous to say no. No. You know, a movie like While You Were Sleeping, which is a great little rom-com with Sandra Bullock from the 90s. That one is about a woman who kind of falls into a situation like this. And, you know, it's very sympathetic to her, but this one doesn't work out that way. And then on top of it, it's like 2 hours and 15 minutes, so it runs long. I mean, you go see a Broadway musical, you're paying probably a couple $100 for the tickets. You've gone to dinner and played a couple $100 for that. You know, you don't want to go to a Broadway musical and be done in 90 minutes because you'll feel ripped off. But on a movie, you got to have a little bit of efficiency, and it doesn't do that. So I didn't like the character. I couldn't get behind him, and I just thought there's a darkness to the story that's already there, but there's an even darker darkness to the story that people don't seem to realize, and it bothers me. It feels unpleasant. So while there's some great elements to it, I'm going to have to say that Dear Evan Hansen kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Creepshow Season 3. The classic Stephen King-inspired horror anthology series continues with new jolting tales of horror.
You're going to have to come closer.
Something's wrong.
We don't have much time.
It's here!
The stories were true.
This isn't a dream. This is really happening.
They're dead. They're all dead.
What did you do?
This is scary.
100%. Simple as that.
This is on Shudder. It's a series. They've done 2 seasons already. I've talked about both of them, I believe, because I'm a huge horror movie fan. It's coming into October. This is part of Shudder's 61 Days of Halloween that I've sort of picked up and taken the name for myself as well, because I'm watching horror movies now. I mean, I don't care that October's still a week away. I'm knee deep. I've decorated the house. I've got skeletons hanging from my lights and bats from my belfry and everything. I love the original Creepshow. It's one of my favorite horror movies ever, and I love the anthology format. Now, when they started doing the Creepshow series, I thought the first season was good, but boy, I really think they hit a stride in season 2. Part of it is they had some unique stories, and they had some great actors in it, and some great guest stars. I have not seen the entirety of Creepshow season 3, but I've seen the first couple episodes. I just don't think the writing's as good this season. At least these first two don't seem to have the punch. And the guest stars don't seem to have the punch. But you don't get Barbara Crampton and Ashley Lawrence and Keith David that you had with the second season. I mean, the second season just really laid it on. And I know you've got Michael Rooker coming up in one of the episodes at some point, because you hear him in the trailer. One of the stories is based on a Joe Hill story, which, that's great, that's Stephen King's son, so you keep it in the family, but it doesn't quite click. And the second one in the first episode, it feels very amateurish. It's leaning more into Tales from the Dark Side from the 80s than it is leaning into a quality Creepshow adaptation. Now, the second episode gets a little bit better, but they still have to deal with stuff. And so there's one with this thing about a guy, he has horror memorabilia, and it gets a little overly nasal-gazing, and it also has this weird fanboy fantasy romance in there that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So, I mean, it feels a little bit like that one with Justin Long and Horror Express from the previous season. But I gotta say, you know, Creepshow season 3, I'm a little disappointed in the quality of the writing. I think that it could be better, but hopefully through the rest of the month it'll get better. So I'm looking forward to that. But right now, your mileage may vary. I'm still gonna say it kind of rocks just because I like the format, but I'm gonna say you're gonna have to tread cautiously.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Foundation and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring The Gateway and 1982's Alone in the Dark. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the reviews. Let's talk about a new series debuting on Apple TV Plus, and that is Foundation. Based on Isaac Asimov's classic novel, this story follows a group of mathematicians who seek to preserve the knowledge of a collapsing galactic empire.
You're familiar with my work, Psychohistory?
Every mathematician has read your theory.
It's not a theory. It's the future of mankind expressed in numbers. And the Empire won't like the future I predict.
This
History is littered with charlatans and false messiahs.
We should kill them.
We can murder the man, but what about the movement, brother? Martyrs tend to have a long half-life.
As people know who've listened to the show, my father passed away about a year ago, and he was a huge Isaac Asimov fan. And he read the Foundation series when it came out. I think when it was serialized, I think it was Astounding Magazine was where it was originally appearing. And I read the Foundation series when I was in high school. I've subsequently read it again. But it was always a bittersweet thing when I found out they were making this series, because I was like, oh, my dad would have loved to have seen it. But even though I knew they were making it before he passed, I knew he'd never make it to the premiere of it showing up on TV. So I never let him know. I would have been interested to see what his reaction is, because there's a real purity to Asimov's stuff. And if you go back to especially to his stuff from the 50s, it is very much that gee whiz science fiction. It's the classic looks of the sleek rocket and the people in jumpsuits and, you know, Forbidden Planet looking stuff. It does not have the look of today, where there's this look of science fiction that almost looks nomadic, where, you know, you no longer get the high society look of it. Part of it is in Foundation, the Galactic Empire does represent the fall of Rome. But there's a lot of extra stuff thrown in there. And David S. Goyer's behind it, and it feels like in some ways he's trying to do a Game of Thrones in space. You don't feel like people are living in modern or beyond modern places. You feel like they live in caves still. And even when they start setting up the Foundation, which is this compendium of knowledge that's being built in this faraway world, you feel like you're building it in... And I don't know, there's a bleakness to it. You don't feel like you're building something that's going to save civilization. You feel like you're just in a cave again. And there's a generic look of desolation and grayness that you see in stuff. You saw that with Raised by Wolves, and even though I liked that one, I saw that I talked about that with a couple of the other sci-fi movies, like, was it Travelers or something like that? And it's one of the things I'm worried about Dune, when that comes out, as good as it's going to look on the big screen, is it just going to look like a bunch of people in dark gray outfits against a light gray background? And that's kind of the way I feel about this. I also feel it takes a lot of the mathematics and cerebral elements. It puts it aside and is more about people talking. And yeah, the Asimov stories followed the politics, but there was also a healthy dose of cynicism. And there was a lot of politics versus religion that was brought in there with Asimov's work. So I think it's sort of like a partial realization. And they're dropping the first two episodes on Apple TV this week. And you get a new one every week, I think, through November sometime. So I'm looking forward to seeing where it goes. But I feel it's straying quite a bit away from the Foundation idea while still trying to do cerebral science fiction. So... I'm optimistically going to say it kind of rocks, but I do have reservations.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. The first movie I want to hit really quickly is on VOD, and it's on Blu-ray, I believe, right now. It just came out a couple weeks ago on Blu-ray, and that is The Gateway. An overzealous social worker struggles with his own life as he fights to save a woman and her daughter from her dangerous convict father.
You're the man who's been looking after my family, huh?
I'm back.
I'd love nothing more than have to come by here anymore.
Prodigal son is home.
Caught some chatter on the inside that might be a real score.
You take care of business.
We're going in there for the money and the drugs.
I'm worried about Ashley. I'm also concerned for you.
What you think you
came to see me.
Tell me this isn't happening again.
Why are you even helping us?
No one helped me when I needed it most.
This one stars Shea Whingham as the social worker and Olivia Munn as the woman. And it's one of those films that's meant to be very gritty. It's showing the gritty underbelly. And it's called The Gateway because it takes place in St. Louis, which has a lot of crime issues. It's not the tongue-in-cheek kind of thing like we had with Cop Shop last week. It's much more serious. And at times it takes itself too seriously. I got to say, you know, at times it's exhausting to watch. But, I mean, there's good performances. I like Shea Whingham. And it's neat to see him get a leading role where he can kind of shine. it's clearly making a statement about the problematic childcare and like foster system and protective services in some large cities, in particular St. Louis. The problem is that is a hugely complex equation because there's always the desire to keep kids with their families, but then parents can be terrible. And it's very difficult to know when you can take them out. And then you have an overloaded foster care system. So it's very hard to maintain, you know, a good relationship all the time with people who have social workers checking in on them. So it would have been neat if it focused more on the futility of trying to fix certain things. And it does focus on that one character. So it does kind of fall into the trap of turning into a single character story, whereas I think it at a time abandons its full focus, which is there's this great problem that our cities are failing the children. But, you know, eventually it has to be focused on the characters. Like I said, it's a little bit heavy for my tastes, and it does lay it on pretty thick. But I mean, it's a commendable performance by Wingham. And of course, Olivia Munn does a good job in it. It's got some action. It's got some neat moments to it. It's got some bad guys in there that you really don't like. So, you know, I if you like that sort of thing, if you can handle the heaviness of it, you know, it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's do another one really quickly, and that is Alone in the Dark. No, not the Uwe Boll movie from the early 2000s. This is from 1982. It's coming out as a collector's edition on Blu-ray from Scream Factory. A blackout in a small town results in three murderous psychopaths that escape from a mental institution, terrorizing the family of one of their doctors.
Are you afraid of the dark?
Sometimes. Sort of fun.
What's that?
When I was a little kid, I was scared to death to be alone in the dark. I always knew that there was something that I couldn't see that wanted to get me.
Like I said, this is from 1982, and it's not a slasher movie. It's a horror movie, but it does have slasher movie elements to it. It's the first movie that New Line Cinema actually produced itself in its pre-Freddy Krueger days. And the best part about this movie is the cast. I mean, you've got Donald Pleasence playing one of the doctors at the hospital. And the thing with Donald Pleasence, the reason he's so good in this role is because he's so aloof. And this is sort of venting the writer's spleen about pop psychology of the day. I mean, we're coming out of the 70s here where the I'm okay, you're okay movement. But you've also got, as some of the people in the loony bin, for lack of a better term, you've got Martin Landau and you've got Jack Palance. And these guys are fantastic. These are great actors. And they play these psychopaths stuck in this ward. You know, what's funny is on the special features, the director talks about how this was actually based on an idea that there was this blackout in New York City and everybody went looting and went crazy because all the burglar alarms were not working. And it's funny because you watch this movie and there's this blackout and it's just a small little town. And you're like, what happened? I mean, I've been in blackouts before and people weren't going crazy and burning down houses. So this is a little, it's just bizarre because it has these elements that are goofy and silly in the script that don't work. But it has these other just fantastic horror movie elements. There's some good stalking scenes and there's some good, truly unnerving moments and some great slasher elements to it as well. And it's different. And weirdly enough, it also is one of the first times you see a hockey mask in a horror movie. And it was made, I think it was in production when Friday the 13th Part 3 was in production. So it's not playing off of Friday the 13th. It's just at one point somebody's wearing a hockey mask. So it has these weird iconic images that don't mean to be iconic, but they do work. It's a fun little non-slasher movie, and it works as a horror film. Now, the Blu-ray, it's a new Blu-ray from Screen Factory. It has a bunch of interviews with like the director and one of the actors and this punk band, which I can't say their name, but the punk band that was in the movie, they catch up with them and it's got like theatrical trailers and a TV spot. I'm going to have to say that the Alone in the Dark Blu-ray totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
And that's it. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about The Many Saints of Newark and Venom, Let There Be Carnage. Until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.